Welcome to the Scene Jim podcast. I'm Ghassan Abu Zainuddin, and I teach fiction writing and Arab American literature at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The Scene Jim podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies and the Arab American National Museum. Joining us today is Susan Mwadi Daraj. Susan's short story collection, A Curious Land, Stories from Home, was named the winner of the AWP Grace Paley Prize for Short Fiction, judged by Jaime Manrique. It also won the 2016 Arab American Book Award, a 2016 American Book Award, and was shortlisted for a Palestine Book Award. Her previous short story collection, The Inheritance of Exile, was published in 2007 by the University of Notre Dame Press. In 2018, she was named a Ford Fellow by USA Artist. Susan also is a two-time recipient of an Individual Artist Award from the Maryland State Arts Council. She has also been awarded a Ruby's Artist Grant from the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance and a grant from the Sustainable Arts Foundation. In 2019, she launched the viral hashtag TweetYourTobe social media campaign to promote Palestinian culture. Later that year, she was named winner of the Rose Nadzet Award by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, an award given by the Nadzet family to a person who, quote, demonstrates an unwavering dedication and commitment to values of equality and justice. In January 2020, Capstone Books launched her debut children's chapterbook series, Farah Rocks, about a smart, brave Palestinian-American girl named Farah Hajar. Today, we will discuss Susan's chapterbook series. There are four volumes in the series, including Fifth Grade, Summer Break, New Beginnings, and Florida. The last in the series, Florida, will come out later this summer. Welcome to Scene Jim, Susan.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So the series starts off with Farah as a fifth grader. In the first volume, she aspires to transfer to Magnet School, public school for gifted students that focuses on science and math. At her current school, she encounters a bully who terrifies her and also taunts her younger brother. In explaining her family name, Farah says, "I've been called Farah Rocks since kindergarten. Our last name, Hajar, means rocks in Arabic. We got that name because my Baba's family were stonecutters in Jerusalem." Susan, I was wondering if you don't mind maybe reading the opening chapter of Fifth Grade, the first book in the series, just to give our listeners a taste of Farah's distinctive voice.
I'd love to. Thank you. Yeah, so this is chapter one of Farah Rocks Fifth Grade, and this is where you'll meet Farah and her brother as well as her parents. So, chapter one. "Fawa, where's Mama?" asks my little brother Samir. He is holding his green light-up sneakers with Tommy Turtle on the sides. Mama bought them at a yard sale because they look new. But right now they look awful. The bottoms are caked with mud. "You should have worn your boots outside," I tell him. "It's the last day of winter break. The snow has turned all mushy and brown." "Biddi Mama," he says. "She's on the phone," I explain. I don't say that it will probably be a long time before she's done. That's because she's talking to Mrs. Liu, the mother of my official best friend, Ali. And they're talking about their favorite subject, the Magnet Academy. For 2 years, our moms have been talking about Magnet. But lately, because our applications are due in 6 weeks, it's been even worse than usual. Ali and I are fifth graders at Harbortown Public School. For middle school, we're hoping to get into Magnet. It's a public school, but with a special focus on science and math. Ali and I have heard that Magnet students end up getting jobs as astronauts and chemists and heart surgeons. Samir groans, snapping me out of my thoughts about Magnet. "I want clean sneakers for tomorrow." "Come on," I tell him. We head to the kitchen. If Mama is still on the phone, I can clean the sneakers for him. I help my parents a lot taking care of Samir. Baba is flipping pancakes at the stove. He likes to make breakfast food for dinner or dinner food for breakfast. Sometimes he even grills hamburgers at 9 o'clock in the morning. He says the chef makes the rules. Mama is leaning against the counter, her cell phone to her ear. "What science classes should they take?" she says. Pause. Yes, I agree. And we'll sign them both up for Latin, of course. Allie and I are really excited for Latin. One of the reasons that she and I are official best friends is because in second grade, Harbortown labeled us gifted, and they put us in advanced academic classes. The school says gifted means that we are really smart, but for us, gifted means we just get more homework than everybody else. Even though I don't like the word gifted, I am thrilled about going to Magnet. I've already thought of a dozen ideas for my essay, but I refuse to work on it tonight, I decide. This is the last day of my winter break. I want to enjoy it. Of course, I think, as I start looking under the sink for a scrub brush, cleaning Samir's muddy sneakers isn't exactly fun. Baba flips a pancake and tells Mama, "Food's almost ready." Mama nods at Baba. "Maybe we'll get our families together for dinner soon," she says into the phone. Pause. "Thanks. Good night, Lynn." After Mama hangs up, she sings to herself in Arabic, looking all dreamy. She snaps out of it when she asks me what I'm doing under the sink. I point to Samir. "Your shoes, Samir," she exclaims, horrified. "How can you wear these to a madrasa tomorrow?" "Sorry." Samir has trouble pronouncing his R's. It's not a huge problem compared to all the other health problems he's had. "Thanks, Farah, but I'll clean them myself later. Go put them by the back door," Mama says. "Are you ready to eat?" "Yes," we say together. Eating Baba's pancakes is even more awesome than hearing him say pancakes. In Arabic, the letters P and V don't even exist, so Baba just replaces them both with the letter B. It's the closest he can get when he's speaking English. Mama came to the United States when she was my age, but Baba came when he was 28. "Farah has to complete her application for Magnet," Baba says. He puts a plate heaped with fluffy pancakes on the table. "Did you start?" he asks me, pouring everyone a glass of juice. "I just have to write the essay," I say. I use my knife to saw through a stack of three pancakes oozing with syrup. "What are you writing about?" Samir asks. "Oh, why Magnet should accept me. I'm not sure what to say, because I'm smart or because I'm awesome or because I'm amazing. Or maybe because you are so confident," Baba says with a grin. Samir pats my shoulder. "Those are good ideas," he says seriously. In Samir's world, I'm like a hero. Most kids think little brothers are annoying, but not me. I'm glad that he thinks I'm his cool big sister. Samir is 6 years younger than I am. My parents were excited for another baby, but Samir arrived too quickly, 3 months too quickly. Even though I was only in preschool, I knew this was bad news. He stayed in the hospital for 3 months. The doctors thought he might not live. Mama and Baba made a promise then. If Samir would just be okay, they would donate a new stained glass window to our church. That's St. Jude's, the Orthodox church that all the Arabs like us attend. And Samir did come home looking like a tiny bald bird. So my parents bought the window, which is taller than my dad, and really expensive. In fact, we're still paying for it. It's one reason why my parents worry about money. Another reason is all of Samir's therapy, which costs tons of money. He needs extra help, and luckily Harbortown is great. He gets pulled out of kindergarten class to work on his speech. And once a week, an occupational therapist helps him. They work on holding a pencil and printing his letters. "Well, Farah," Baba says to me now, "when will you finish it?" "Baba," I whine, "it's the last day of winter break. I'll start this week, I promise." "Inshallah, you will," Mama says. I know, I interrupt her. "Inshallah, I will get accepted." "We will pray," Baba says, and then he stuffs a fork full of pancakes into his mouth.
Thank you. Thanks for reading that, Susan. Farah is just a really delightful character. She's smart, funny, courageous. She loves math, science, and geology. She reads a lot of Greek mythology. Later in the series, we learned that she likes writing stories as well. She's protective over her younger brother, and she's loving and affectionate toward her parents. What was the inspiration behind her character?
There were lots of different things that kind of came together to inspire her character. I think when I entered the world of writing children's books as opposed to writing for adults, I sort of came into the field of children's literature or kid lit at a really interesting time. We are having this moment now, this movement called the Own Voices Movement in children's writing, because teachers and parents and writers and publishers are really making this important point that children need to see themselves in books. Having a great imagination is one thing. I mean, I read books when I was a kid about characters of all backgrounds, and I had no trouble, like, you know, imagining myself in that place. But it is true that there was sort of a deficit in that I never really saw myself reflected back in a book. It was always me, the reader, making the effort of imagining myself as the character. And I think that that's something that, for example, that white children do not experience. White children see themselves in books all the time. And there have been a lot of studies conducted about this, that in fact, if you look at the number of children's books published every year, there are more books that feature a protagonist that's an animal than books that feature children of color. So if you take Native American children, Latinx children, African American children, put all those books together, books featuring those children as protagonists, there are more books about animals than about those children. And still over 50% of books being published still feature a white protagonist. So I kind of entered the field of children's publishing, you know, I got my start during this, when this conversation was coming to a real like mature level. And, you know, I just wanted to write books for Arab kids. I mean, I wanted my own kids to read books about Arab characters. Cause I've said this before in other venues, that my daughter said to me when she was 10, she's a wonderful avid reader. She asked me why there aren't books with Arab characters in them. And it really struck me because I had asked the same question at her age. And so for nothing to have changed really that much in 30 years, I said, well, you know, I read a lot of children's books and I'm a writer. Let me try to create a book for her and for other Arab children. And I came up with this character of Farah. Her name means joy in Arabic, and I wanted to create a character who was a joyful character. I wanted to create a character whose ethnic background does not create a conflict for her. She's not really straddling two cultures with any difficulty. I mean, she's seamlessly moving between her Arab household and her American school and so on and so forth. I just wanted to create a character who was happy being an Arab American kid.
Right. And you kind of touched on this. There aren't many examples of Arab American writers who are writing today for a younger audience. And there aren't many examples of Arab American characters featured in books for children or young adults. I mean, with this in mind, did you feel any pressure in writing this series?
So I would actually just say that there are a lot of people writing, a lot of Arab American writers writing children's books. They're just not being published. So I know of several writers who are having to self-publish books because they're having trouble finding acquisition editors who want to take a chance on an Arab American character. And I'll tell you, the reason for that is really troubling to me. The publishing world is still like 85% white. And so it's interesting that most editors tend to be very progressive people and they want Arab American stories. Actually, when you talk to them, when I meet them at conferences or I meet them in other venues, they want Arab American stories, but they have a script in their head about what an Arab American story is. So I'll tell you that if anyone out there is an Arab American writer and they want to get rich overnight, all you have to do is write a novel or a book about a young Arab American girl who's rebelling against her patriarchal oppressive family, and you will have a New York Times bestseller. I mean, it's not hard, especially if your name is like super Arabic. That'll make publishers feel very authentic. So that's such a problem, you know, Hassan, because the Arab American experience is just as diverse as any other community's experience. Do we have stories of oppression? Yes, of course we do. Every society does. Every community does. But we also have a lot of happy young people who are navigating growing up in America, just like other kids are. And so like Farah is dealing with a bully. She's dealing with school problems. Her brother has learning disabilities. These are problems other kids are going through. Her family is financially unstable in many ways, you know, so these are problems lots of kids go through. So I think in all of its efforts to be inclusive, the publishing industry is actually trying to narrow down what types of stories it gives a platform to. So yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think my previous publishing experience and awards probably helped me get this book series out there. And I think things are changing. I hope they're changing. And I hope that publishers will be more receptive to just the vast range of stories that are coming out of our community.
Right. That's interesting. And feel like the need to maybe break some of the stereotypes that like the publishing industry might have of Arab Americans. I asked that, you know, you mentioned like what maybe a lot of publishers want, like that stereotypical version of the patriarchal father who oppresses the woman of his family. But in your case, the father in Farah Rock series, he's a very loving father. You know, he works hard at the quarry. There's that scene of him cooking the pancakes in the kitchen. So it's like also breaking some of those stereotypes.
I actually deliberately put him in the very first chapter for that reason. So when you meet Abdullah Hajar, he is flipping pancakes. He's making pancakes for his kids. I did that very deliberately. I wanted to establish from the very beginning of the book that this is a father who loves his daughter and he wants her to do well and succeed and thrive. And he's a loving husband as well. And he's very much involved in his children's lives because I know tons of fathers like that. My father's like that. You're like that. This is how many Arab men are. Again, are there Arab men who are not like that? Yes, of course, you know, but that's not the one I want to spotlight in my book. I want to break some of the stereotypes or not even break them. You know, Hassan, I just want to complicate them a little bit, just make them more realistic by providing different portraits of Arab American life, I guess.
Yeah. And you were saying that Farah has problems that many other students her age will have, right? Whether it's countering the bully, in her particular case, her socioeconomic struggles, which we'll talk about a bit later. And yet at the same time, she does communicate certain aspects of an Arab identity. She speaks in English, but she does understand Arabic. You know, there are a few moments where her parents speak to her in Arabic and she understands. One comedic refrain that she has is holy hummus when she's astonished, surprised, incredulous, or scared of something. You know, she says holy hummus, and she enjoys eating Arabic food, including kusa mahshi, and she explains what that is. In Farah's words, she says in describing kusa mahshi, you know, yellow squash stuffed with rice and beef served over hot rice and roasted almonds. And yet in the first book, she does get bullied by this newcomer named Dana. And Dana has a hard time pronouncing Farah's name. And instead, she calls her Pharaoh, right? Can you talk about that also? Just like how Farah, how she navigates her Arab American identity and how you tried to capture that over the course of the books in the series?
Yeah, I should tell listeners, actually, in the very back of the book, I've included a recipe for Farah's holy hummus recipe, because I, you know, there's a joke among a lot of Arab Americans about the types of, let's say, hummus brands that lack authenticity in the stores. I just saw one the other day. It was red velvet dessert hummus. And I thought to myself, Lord have mercy. I've included in the back of the book, every book has an activity or something. So the very first book has Farah's holy hummus recipe. Yeah, Farah is, again, she moves seamlessly between worlds. And the other characters in the book are also quite diverse as well. So her best friend, Ali Liu, is Chinese American. Ali has the same experience. Her parents speak Chinese at home, goes to school, speaks English, and that's not a problem. You know, there's not a conflict in doing. Yeah, Farah, in fact, when this bully calls her Pharaoh and kind of mildly pokes fun at her ethnicity, it's a surprise to Farah because she's just not used to that, right? She's not used to that kind of environment.
That's right.
She kind of considers herself to be not even a hyphenated American, but just like a person with where her two cultures just are fused together into like a third kind of hybrid. Like there's not like really a separation in that sense. It's a fluid back and forth between her two worlds. I think I've tried to stress that her parents contribute to that. You know, her parents are both immigrants, but they want her to feel comfortable with her identities. And so things work well for her in that sense. Like her identity is not a burden in her life. A lot of writing for children of color, we call it like crisis literature, and it's really unfortunate. There are a lot of books for children of color in which their race or their ethnicity is the point of the crisis in the book. And I did not want that for my character. You know, this is the first chapter book series to feature an Arab American or a Palestinian American character. And I didn't want her ethnicity to be the point of trauma in her life. So I deliberately, you know, avoided that.
That's really interesting. Right. And as you alluded to, you know, one of her friends, Ali, is Chinese American. And there are a lot of other characters featured in this book series who are people of color. For instance, in the first book, there's one of Farah's teachers. His name is Mr. Ritchie. And Farah, in explaining him, she says, Mr. Ritchie is African-American, and he particularly worries about kids who aren't white and how we're doing at school. He tries to be extra aware in case someone makes us feel different, since there aren't too many of us at Harbortown. Yeah, I found that really very touching. And I guess, you know, yeah, if you can, you kind of alluded to this, but, you know, the importance of including children of color in these series, not only Farah and her family, but her other classmates and teachers at the school itself.
Yeah, I just had a mother who bought the books for her daughter, and she sent me, I get a lot of emails from people who've read the book, and she said that she and her daughter, they're African-American, and it was just like a pleasant surprise to learn later in the book that Mr. Ritchie is actually, because I don't mention that he's African-American until the point is needed to be made, but that they're pleasantly surprised to learn that the math teacher at this in this honors program is an African-American man. I created a world, I think, a world that I did not grow up in. Like I created a world for Farah in which diversity is like a beautiful thing, and everyone's for the most part on the same page about inclusion. I tell this story about how when I was growing up, when I brought Arabic food to my school for lunch, it was something I would hide. My mother would make like mena'ish with za'atar, you know, and like, I mean, like the kids could not believe I was eating it. You know, it was always something to be talked about and snickered at, and look, she's eating dirt on her sandwich.
I got ants when my mom made me za'atar, right, with thyme. I got that comment. Oh, what are you eating, ants on bread?
Ants on bread. Yeah, and I know my mother would make hummus and include it in my lunch. It was always a point of commentary, and it's so bizarre to me, Ghassan, that now, like when my children were younger, and their friends were bringing hummus in their own lunches. Like these white children were eating hummus with like chia seed crackers and carrots and celery, you know? And it's like, where have we gone? Like it's so beautiful to see that, right? That this is now like a commonplace thing. Even, you know, I've had a couple of moms of my children's friends call me and ask for the recipe for hummus. They want to start making it at home. Like, it's nice that like, in a sense, like our children are not going through like what we went through, that feeling of having to hide something about yourself in the cafeteria, right? The cafeteria is like the great stage of middle school drama where everything plays out. So the fact that you don't have to really hide anymore, I think is a nice thing. And I wanted to capture that a bit in the book.
And in books 2 and 3, Farah doesn't get along with another Palestinian American girl her age named Lana Khoury. Farah refers to Lana as her nemesis. As Farah explains, just because Lana and I are both Palestinian American girls who are in the same grade, people seem to think we should be best friends. Here's why we aren't. Lana thinks she's better than me. So although you do introduce several Palestinian American characters in this series, it doesn't mean they all get along with one another. Right. And Lana is an example of that. Right. What did you have in mind with Lana as a character in books 2 and 3?
I think every Arab American has had a Lena Khoury in their life. Lena is just a girl who's very, very privileged, and doesn't know she's privileged. We all know people like that. And so Farah's family is, of course, financially on the precipice. Her father works in a stone quarry. Her mother has a part-time job that she tries to get overtime as much as possible. This causes Farah to have to often, at the age of 11, babysit her brother at home. So when Farah needs something, she's very hesitant often to ask her parents to buy her something new that she needs. So Lena is her foil. Lena's super privileged, super spoiled. And Lena's also mean, right? She feels good when she makes other people feel bad. We all know people like that. I think it's very important for, as a children's writer, for me to be very honest with my readers. Children do not stand it to have a writer talk down to them in any way. And so kids know that there are mean kids. Like, even if you go to a church and everybody talks about being Christian and treat others as you want to be treated, every kid knows there are kids at that church that are not nice kids, right? There are kids at school who are just not nice kids. And so I think it's important to just be honest with kids and just reflect back to them the world that they experience, that they see. And I think that they engage with you more as in terms of being your readers. They're more engaged in your work when you're honest with them and you give them honest portrayals of the people that they themselves may be encountering in their lives. So Lena Khoury is, you know, she's sort of like the composite character, every privileged character that my readers may know. And yeah, definitely. I mean, in the Arab American experience, we have a whole range of characters, right? And so Lena is just one of those.
In addition to featuring children of color and people of color in your series, you also feature children with disabilities. For instance, Farah's brother Samir was born prematurely and he has some disabilities. You also describe some of his classmates who have disabilities. Can you talk about the importance of humanizing people with disabilities, children with disabilities in your series?
Yeah, this was something that was really difficult for me to do because I don't have this experience of raising a child with a disability. So Samir was born prematurely. He's a lot younger than Farah. And it was very important to me to find a way to demonstrate how funny and witty and sweet he is, and to make sure he's not being defined by his disability, right? I have two very good friends who are raising children with disabilities. And so they were kind enough to read Samir's character for me and give me some feedback on how realistic he seemed and things like that. Yeah, it was important for me to do that because I think that a lot of children who have physical or learning disabilities are also treated as if they have intellectual disabilities and they don't. I personally find Samir to be just like this hilarious character. He makes very witty observations about people and things around him. And he often makes the way that young children do. He's a very honest and insightful observer of what's happening around him. Like, everybody might be talking around an issue, but Samir gets right to the point and makes usually an insightful observation about something. So I think that was something that was a learning experience for me as a writer to create his character. And I don't think we have enough characters in books also who are children who have various range of disabilities. There's a book that my daughter was reading, a graphic novel called El Defo. It's a wonderful graphic novel about a girl with a hearing disability. And it's just magnificently done because, you know, you fall in love with her character and her disability just becomes part of her character. It's not who she is. It's just kind of like a characteristic of her. And I thought that was very well done. So I attempted to do that. I think in our society, we often, in fact, use very hurtful language that is ableist language and very damaging. I just remember the other day, ever since the Trump era, during the 4 years that we lived through the Trump era, I heard newscasters and political commentators using the word crazy and insane all the time, very freely, you know. Mm-hmm. It's very hurtful language, you know, it's ableist language, but our society just uses that language all the time. So anyway, yeah, I wanted to sort of uplift or create, you know, a space for a character with a disability in this book. It's something that I'm very aware of as a mother, as a writer.
Yeah, you alluded to growing up in a Palestinian American community or an Arab community. And, you know, in reading the books in this series, I did get a sense of a Palestinian American community. Community members help each other out when they can. They often see each other on Sundays at church. You also capture this sense of Arab American community in your short story collection, The Inheritance of Exile. Can you talk about your own experience growing up in a Palestinian American community? You grew up in Philadelphia, correct?
Yeah, it was wonderful. I grew up in South Philadelphia, and we had in the larger Philadelphia area a really vibrant and large Palestinian American community. It was a very diverse community. It was a Christian and Muslim community. For example, as Christian kids, we attended Arabic school at the local, like there was a mosque that was running Arabic classes. You know, they would run them at the local university, but it was the mosque's like parent association that was doing that. And we would participate in that. Religiously, you know, we had friends who we celebrated Eid with them, and they would celebrate, you know, Christmas with us. And we also had a very politically active community. I think I was very politically aware of the issue of Palestine since I was a very little kid. You know, especially the mothers in our community did a lot of this work. For example, my mother did a lot of organizing work when I was young. She would write to the police department to get permission for a demonstration. She would circulate petitions for other things. She would organize meetings. They would hold fundraisers. Whenever something happened in Palestine, there would be like a fundraising effort to send money for medical expenses or, you know, things like that. We had an organization, the Palestine Aid Society, that our parents were very involved in and that as kids we were involved in. Like we became involved in those organizations. It was a perfect blend, I think, of like religious awareness, cultural awareness, and political awareness. And I feel very lucky to have grown up in that environment. And I'm still very close to all the people that I grew up with, you know, in my childhood, all my Palestinian American friends that I grew up with. I'm still very close with all of them. So, and I see a lot of them like replicating the work that our parents did, you know, in their own lives now, in their own communities with their own children. So it's very nice to see that. And I wanted to maybe replicate that in this book with Farah, that she belongs to a community that's, you know, there are some Lenas in that community, right? But there are also some like really wonderful people. Like you're never really alone when you have a community. So.
Right. And, you know, you've been publishing fiction and nonfiction for years. And I'm curious, what were some of the challenges in writing for a younger audience that you may not have encountered in your other works?
I had to learn a lot, I'll be honest with you. My first editor, children's editor, her name is Eliza Leahy. And she was marvelous. She's the acquisitions editor who dealt with my agent when they were kind of negotiating this book deal. And I'm very grateful to her because she is a woman who I believe lived and worked in the Minneapolis area and was doing work for a while with Mizna, the Arab American literary magazine. And so she's just very in tune with and very aware of Arab American literature. And so she was excited to acquire the first chapter book series to feature an Arab American character. So I was lucky to have her support for my idea. She never tried to change my vision for Farah, for the character. But she also taught me a lot about writing for children because it was something new for me. And the first thing I really learned from her, you know, and you learn it not through lectures or anything, but you learn it through this editing process. I learned not to underestimate my reader. I learned to really respect the young reader as a very aware and perceptive reader. Honestly, in the back of my mind, I thought to myself, because I was originally writing this for my daughter, I guess I thought to myself, well, how hard can it be to write a children's book, right? Like Madonna writes children's books. You know, every celebrity on earth, it seems like, is writing a children's book series. You know, I think, you know, the guy who plays Fonzie, Henry Winkler, is writing a children's book. Like, if I'm actually a writer. Like, I can write a children's book, but I think I didn't quite know how to treat my reader yet. I was maybe softening things for the reader. And I remember Eliza just saying, you know, just tell them what it is. Just say that they don't have the money. Just say it, you know? And so I think I learned how to respect my reader's intelligence and ability to understand difficult issues. And the more I learn about it, the more I read, I mean, I read children's books, I read young adult novels all the time. I actually find that the kid lit world is really the place where a lot of boundaries are being pushed. It's in the kid lit publishing world where you're seeing, for example, LGBTQ characters, where you're seeing more children dealing with gun violence as part of the plot, children dealing with police brutality as part of the plot. So children's book writers are really the ones who I think are writing very openly about lots of issues because they know children are dealing with those issues. There's no point in romanticizing any of it, right? So that's something I had to learn. Other things I had to learn had to do with things like children's writing is leveled writing. So you have to make sure that your book is targeted to a certain reading level. That means sometimes choosing a word with less syllables or, you know, making your sentences a little bit more complex to kind of hit that reading level that you need to hit. So stuff like that, I had to also learn as well.
Right. And how do you feel now that the series has come to an end?
Yeah, it's so the fourth book is coming out this summer in July 2021. And it's called Farah Rocks Florida. So Samir is going to be very sick in this book. He's going to have a bit of a relapse. And so he'll be in the hospital for a bit. And so during his recovery, her parents sent Farah to Florida to stay with her grandmother, Siti Fairuz. Siti Fairuz does not speak English, and she's appalled that Farah does not speak Arabic that well. So there's that bit of a, you know, conflict there. And Siti Fairuz is very strict about lots of things that Farah is not accustomed to. So there's a bit of tension with that. But yeah, but that book comes out in the summer, and it's the fourth and final book in the series. Who knows, there might be more in the future, but this set is definitely complete now. And I feel very grateful that this book has gotten the reception it has. I mean, I've had teachers, schools, libraries purchase the book, and they're telling me it's circulating very well. There's an interest in it. There's a hunger for it. That makes me very happy. That's why I did it. You know, I really did it to give Arab kids like a mirror to see themselves. And that makes me happy that Arab kids are enjoying it, but also that non-Arab kids are getting just another insight into our community. That makes me happy.
Well, thank you, Susan, for joining us on the Seeing Jean podcast today. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you to our audience out there for listening. Today's episode of the Seeing Jean podcast was hosted by Hassan Abu Zainuddin. It was produced by Asma Baban, Muhammad Jafar, and Maryam Reza. It was edited by Muhammad Jafar with support from Eric Kiska. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maysara Abdulhad. Seeing Jean is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Seeing Jean is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Ford Community Development Fund. Thank you for listening.